This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Back up for us and give us some of the details and tell us what's going on, because I'm surprised to learn that, I thought, well, they'll put Saddam Hussein on trial. He was found guilty. They're going to kill him. But when in fact, there could be a dozen trials.
Yeah. Well, actually, the way the trials were designed was for that to quite deliberately be the result, because, this is the situation the prosecutors faced. One option would have been to have one trial that charged him with, all of the accusations of what he had done wrong in, the decades of his rule in Iraq, which would have involved, violence against the Kurdish population in the north, against the Shia in the south, and, various other communities in the country. And the model for that was the prosecutions that were undertaken against Slobodan Milosevic in the former Yugoslavia, for example, where he was charged with 66 different counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide for, a huge array of death and destruction. What was the result? A four-year-long trial, and the guy dies before a single conviction is entered. So what the Iraqi prosecutors decided to do is to proceed in a series of what they would call mini trials. So in other words, you take one set of accusations for one, group of war crimes in one particular region, and you put Saddam on trial for that. And then after a conviction is found in that, you go to the next set of accusations and the next trial. And they've only completed one trial so far. It's a trial that involves the deaths of 148 people in a Shia village called Dujail, which is a place where in the early 1980s there was an unsuccessful assassination attempt against Saddam. What Saddam then did is rounded up members of the community who were supposed to be part of that failed attempt to assassinate him. He had them all prosecuted and executed. So the question is that a crime against humanity or war crime? And the Iraqi Special Tribunal, in fact, found that it was. It sentenced him to death for those particular crimes. But this is one drop in a much larger bucket. And right now, the second set of proceedings are proceedings that are going to continue against him involving violence against the Kurds in the north in a campaign called the Anfal Campaign.
Is that where he gassed those villages?
Exactly. That is where chemical weapons were used against the Kurdish villages. And over 50,000 people, allegedly, were killed. Innocent civilians were killed in those attacks.
My God.
Right. So this is the second trial. And there are going to be several more that involve, violence in different parts of the country. So it's weird how, and this is actually, a concern that I had when they decided to proceed this way. They proceeded this way so that you would have narrower, closer, easier convictions to establish, in an individual series of trials. But one of the problems is that now the guy's convicted. He has a death sentence hanging over him. He can appeal that. After the appeal, if it's unsuccessful, there's a very short period of time in which he can be convicted. So what does that what does that mean? It means that this conviction for 148 murders overshadows other charges that involve the deaths of hundreds of thousands, including potentially for genocidal motivations, like against the Kurds in the north.
Why did they go with this one first?
Because it wasn't the most egregious. Yeah, it's a great question. For the same reason that prosecutors often decide to start with the safest, easiest, cleanest cut case. Here you actually had proof. Saddam signed the execution orders against these people. Some of these people were tortured before they were killed. There was direct evidence implicating Saddam in the deaths. So it was an easy conviction. It's often hard to convict a leader for war crimes because there, often isn't evidence that directly implicates that.
They insulate themselves from what's happening on the ground, yeah.
Exactly. No insulation here. They had in the record the execution orders that he signed, and he, in fact, in his testimony, admitted that he signed it. So it was just an easy case, open, shut door. So that's why they started with it. But, in a sense, I guess my critique of that would be, it's a low stakes, low gain kind of situation, right? And if it overshadows everything else, I think that would be unfortunate. I think it would really be unfortunate if he were executed before the rest of all of these trials took place.
Mark Drumble is director of the Transnational Law Institute at the Washington and Lee University School of Law in Lexington, Virginia. We're talking with him on Charlottesville Right Now, News Radio 1070 WINA. Mark, is it disappointing to you to see justice being done and yet violence in the streets increases?
Yeah, very much so. And in fact, to me, it's interesting because when the tribunal was first set up, when Saddam was pulled out of the spider hole, you know, the theory was, we're going to take this guy, we're going to have a Nuremberg moment, you know, we're going to prosecute him for all of the litany of abuses that he's committed during his rule in Iraq, and somehow this is going to promote national reconciliation in Iraq. This is going to let Iraqis come to deal with their past. This is going to help the country move on and democratize, and, you know, all of these things we associate with the war crimes trial. We're going to see justice done and so forth. And paradoxically, as the trial has continued, there's been more and more and more violence in Iraq. And in fact, the bloodiest days of violence have occurred after Saddam was, you know, convicted and sentenced to death. Now, I don't think that that violence arose in reaction to the fact that some people were upset that he was convicted and sentenced to death. I frankly think that very few Iraqis have any sympathy whatsoever with Saddam or want to, you know, have him reinstalled as a leader. So what it suggests to me, in fact, is that the trial just isn't that important for a lot of Iraqis, and that it certainly isn't succeeding in curbing this kind of ethnic violence or sectarian violence. This doesn't mean we shouldn't convict him if he's found guilty, which in fact he was, and that he shouldn't be sentenced. I'm a big supporter of prosecuting this guy. But I'm also, you know, somewhat circumspect about the actual social effect that prosecuting, convicting, and punishing him will have on stability in Iraq. And I haven't seen any kind of positive correlation so far.
Mark, where exactly is Saddam Hussein? Where exactly is this happening?
Oh, the trial is taking place in an area of Baghdad called the Green Zone, which is sort of the highly securitized enclave where there are a lot of the diplomatic missions and so forth. And it's taking place in a court that was specifically designed and constructed for this purpose. And it's interesting when you think of the architecture of the court. Saddam and the defendants are sort of placed in the middle in this caged area, and in fact sort of gives them an ability to grandstand. The proceedings are all televised. And one thing that did happen in the original proceedings, these Dujail proceedings, that's the name of the village in Iraq where the 148 people were killed that I talked about before. When those proceedings took place, Saddam made full use of the TV to really grandstand, and he called the judge every, you know, insult in the books, and his defense lawyers were very aggressive and in ways that I didn't think were very effective. But it was a bit of a show trial. But, you know, at the end of the day, it didn't calm the country. It didn't quiet things. In fact, things are more unstable now than before, and I do believe there's a sense among a lot of Iraqis that the United States is investing a lot of money, and the Iraqi legal profession is investing a lot of attention in the trial of Saddam and, you know, about a dozen of his acolytes, when nothing is basically being done to curb tremendous levels of sectarian violence and torture today. I mean, we hear in the news of people who are killed in bombings. We hear in the news of, you know, the instability in the country. What we don't hear so much of is that a lot of these deaths are being conducted in the most gruesome fashion. I mean, people are being tortured with electrical drills because they're of a because of sectarian differences, it's really quite tremendous, the level of hatred, and yet there's very little accountability for that today. Instead, we're spending a lot of effort on what happened 24 years ago in one village.
Mark Drumble is professor of law at Washington Lee University. Mark, do us a favor, me included. What exactly does the journalists mean when they say sectarian violence? What exactly do they mean?
They mean violence that has a religious component to it. And in the Iraqi context, that would be violence between the Shiite Muslim community and the Sunni Muslim community. Ethnic violence would be violence between the Kurdish community and then the Sunni and Shia community, which together sort of would represent a different ethnicity. So it's really, there's really three different groups that share, they're all Muslim, all share the Islamic faith. Two of them share a different variant of the Islamic faith, and then the third group is ethnically different and geographically lives in the northern part of the country.
It's
very complicated. And the other thing that doesn't get a lot of attention is that in addition to those layers of differentiation, Iraq is also a society that has a very deep, you know, clan-based aspect to its sort of, you know, its broader social structure. So, you know, there's also that sort of regional clan aspect to a lot of the violence.
Much the same thing we see in Afghanistan with the warlords.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And when violence is committed against, you know, members of a certain family clan, then there's often a collective, you know, retaliation. But the major fault line now in terms of the violence is between Sunni and Shia. In fact, the Kurdish region is in the north is somewhat calmer and, in fact, has done fairly well in following the March 2003 military invasion.
And, of course, all of this traced back to the fact that this country did not evolve on its own. It was created and partitioned off by Britain, right? And at the time, the Shia and the Shiites and the Sunni looked at each other and said, we're not in the same country. What are you thinking? We hate each other.
And I think part of it also relates to the fact that when Saddam was in power, the Sunni were very influential. And now the Shia have become more influential. And as a result, everything is... In Iraq, every single political event necessarily is refracted through or goes through a lens of sectarian and ethnic politics. And, you know, I think this is something that was underappreciated before the military intervention. And I also think one thing that was underappreciated is that, you know, democracy... we think is a solution to all problems, but in many parts of the world, instant democracy can create more problems and often leads to a radicalization of politics because, you know, people push their ethnicity or religion to try to get more votes so that they can sort of become a majority party. So, you know, democracy often can have a dangerous aspect to it. I'm a Democrat, you know, I support democratic government, right? But it often has to evolve. It can't just be imposed.
And certainly it helps a lot if people are literate.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure,
it doesn't really work in an
too.
Illiterate society.
No, and the security situation. I mean, even going back to the Saddam trial, I mean, let's not forget in these little proceedings, three defense lawyers were assassinated. There were judges that rotated on and over, like a musical chair of judges that rotated on and off of the bench. There were constant security threats. I mean, this is like a really dangerous environment. I mean, you know, 200 people are killed, 150 people. This is every day. This is very, very, very dangerous. And to me, I think people want to live today, and the trial is important, but you need to have a certain level of stability so that you have the mental energy, I think, to really focus on this particular trial. And you got to have some comfort in the present, I think, to deal with the past.
Mark Drumble is director of the Transnational Law Institute at the Washington and Lee University School of Law in Lexington. If you'd like to ask him a question or make a comment, we invite you to give us a call at 977-1070. Mark, to what extent does America control those trials about Saddam Hussein, or are the Iraqis completely autonomous?
Well, I think it's sort of somewhere in between. Clearly, formally speaking, the Iraqis control, in the sense that Iraqi judges, Iraqi prosecutors, and it was very important for the Iraqis to control process in that sense. And that's one of the reasons why there was a resistance to having an international court or tribunal adjudicate and prosecute the Ba'ath leadership, like, for example, the international tribunal that is handling genocide in Rwanda and the crimes against humanity and genocide in the Balkans. So in that sense, the Iraqis have control over the tribunal, and it's a national court, and it's part of the national court system. That said, the statute of the tribunal was drafted by the Regime Crimes Liaison Office, which is part of the United States. Funding, the expert advice, a lot of the folks involved with the tribunal are all affiliated with the United States government and, of course, at the time, with the Coalition Provisional Authority.
Margaret is on the line in Albemarle County. Margaret, you're on with Mark Drumble. Go right ahead.
Hi. It sort of disturbs me that the truth is often lost with the polarization of our politics, and especially the side the media takes. It seems to me from reading very liberal magazines like The New Yorker, for years and years now, that even while Saddam was in power, this Sunni, Shiite, and Kurds, they were all fighting amongst each other. Yet now the New York Times, Washington Post, everybody, ABC, whatever, the media, they're all talking about, oh, civil war, civil war. This kind of infighting has been going on, if not for, I mean, thousands of years. It's been going on for decades, but it's really been going on for thousands of years. And I really get very angry that we're not being very honest and truthful when we talk about, you know, it's just an anti-Bush thing, this, civil war. When these three groups have been fighting each other for at least decades.
Margaret, it's a great point. Mark, I've got about a minute left. Go right ahead.
I think I would agree that there have been these tensions in the past. In fact, when the 1990-1991 invasion of Iraq that drove Saddam out of Kuwait took place, the first President Bush actually encouraged the Shia in the South to rise up and have an uprising. They did, and they were all massacred by Saddam's forces. I think there's been tensions in the past. Saddam controlled them through his dictatorship. But in answer to Margaret's point, I think what's different today is where the expectation bar was set. And the expectation bar was set that it would be democracy in Iraq, the Iraqis would control their own government, and that this would be for the better of all Iraqis, and hence the invasion was justified on that basis. The fact that it hasn't worked out, and there is in fact a pronounced level of violence in the country today, to me is disturbing in that particular regard, because it falls short and contradicts the rationale in part for why we have expended so much effort in terms of liberating the Iraqis, when, to me, that, you know, we've fallen short on that expectation. So historically speaking, you're right, but if that were the case, then we thought that democratizing would solve the problem. It hasn't.
Mark Drumble is professor of law at Washington and Lee University School of Law in Lexington. It's been an honor, my friend. Let's talk again soon.
Thank you very much.
Take care. This interview will be archived in its entirety on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.